Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. I am here today to talk about biodiversity and how nature is as important as climate in thinking about how we can prepare the planet for the future. My guests today are Heather Graby, Bruegel Senior Fellow, and one of the authors of a report on biodiversity that you can find on our website, bruegel.org. And we are really lucky today to be joined by Thomas Viegas, who's the Nature Strategy Lead at Aviva, the wealth and investment fund out of the UK. And Thomas is actually working in the market. And I want to emphasize that because one of the cool things about your report, Heather, is it talks about how to get people in the market to care about the nature. Because usually the nature people and the market people don't talk to each other so much. So walk us through how you get them on the same page.
One way is by pointing out that the risks of losing nature have now become really enormous and systemic, essentially. So people tend to think of biodiversity as beautiful photographs of baby elephants and isn't it nice to have rainforests? But actually, by now, nature degradation globally has reached a level where we're at the verge of tipping points where it won't be possible for nature to keep providing the ecosystem services that we all rely on for clean water, for clean air, for pollination. These are really fundamental. And the risks that are building up across many countries and across different economic sectors are not there on the balance sheet. People don't see those risks appearing, but they are definitely there. And when a flood happens, a drought, suddenly businesses can go bankrupt. That can cause systemic risks.
Thomas, how unusual is it for a big player in the market to even have a nature strategy lead?
It's a great question. I think it's something that's growing. I'm fortunate enough to be in that position. And I think, as Heather said, it's recognition, increasing recognition across, you know, the corporate and financial sector that nature is fast becoming a strategic issue and kind of less becoming a corporate social responsibility issue. As Heather outlined, the risks, both in terms of how they're crystallizing, but, you know, they are starting to show up on the balance sheet of many companies all over the world. And that is forcing organizations to recognize that they have to look at this more strategically. They need to look at this through a risk and opportunity management lens, and they need to be looking ahead about how they're going to respond to how they're interfacing with different aspects of the natural world when they're thinking about the transition to come.
And how do you advise them on those risks in your role?
So my role, I'm very fortunate to be sitting within Aviva. You kind of touched on it. We have an insurance investment and we have our direct operations. And so the interface of nature across all of those aspects differ. You know, through our investments, we invest in sectors and firms in the real economy that engage day to day with different aspects of nature and have different dependencies and impacts on different aspects of the natural world. Through our insurance side, we underwrite firms and sectors, and all of those sectors will be, again, having dependencies and impacts as well. And then through our own operations, we're exposed directly to potential risks, you know, from our own sites and supply chains. So in my role, it's really about making sure that as an organization as a whole, we have a whole of business of approach to ultimately a whole of society problem, which is nature loss, and making sure that the kind of data modeling, the technical expertise is shared and distributed in a way across the organization to make sure that we're thinking or prioritizing areas when we're thinking about our investments, insurance, and our operations in ways that can have the most impact for us as a firm, but also crucially that we're engaging with industry, we're engaging with policymakers, given the systemic nature of the problem, as Heather mentioned, because we know that the actions we do in isolation won't be enough to be able to solve the nature crisis that we are currently in.
It is so interesting to have to do that for a whole group, because I can imagine that the, you know, wealth management and sort of portfolio management aspects of this are really different from, you know, policy pricing and claims risk and things like that. How do we think about nature as distinct from climate, or is it a subset, or how do they go together?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think we've really come on a journey. I say we, the market, I think to an extent, you know, policymakers are to an extent, so kind of academia that, you know, climate's kind of been the big brother in many ways. You know, it had its kind of moment of glory in Paris in 2015. We've seen subsequent huge initiatives such as the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures. And we've seen kind of a number of initiatives, and kind of nature really only started to come into the mainstream eye, you know, around the start of this decade, so around 2020, 2021. But really momentum has been huge. So I think in terms of kind of the action, it's really been, you know, kind of staggered. But I think a positive about that staggering is that a lot of the work that we've seen, you know, being done on nature has been trying to already highlight those really inherent and, you know, evident science-based links between climate change and nature loss and how they interplay and how they fundamentally depend on each other. I think it's also increasingly clear, you know, from the range of scientific evidence that, you know, for net zero in and of itself, there is no net zero without nature. We know that the degradation of ecosystems globally account for around a fifth of GHG emissions that are being emitted through degraded ecosystems. But we also know that nature-based solutions, if done well, could provide around a third of the mitigation or sequestration needed by 2030 to help us with our 2050 global goals. So we know that nature is fundamental to our climate goals and ambition. But again, we also now, and through an increasing body of evidence, are appreciating that nature in and of itself is absolutely imperative for the prosperity and resilience of businesses, the economy, and society at large.
That is a really striking number, that by fixing nature, we can also improve our climate situation. All this stuff costs money. Heather, how much do you think is needed to address some of these issues? What did you find?
Well, there are quite a few different estimates of both the global financing gap and also in Europe how much money we need. The Global Biodiversity Framework has identified funding needs where they're asking the international community to provide money, particularly for preservation of nature in the global south, and also restoration of ecosystems, because it's intact ecosystems that provide ecosystem services really effectively. And these are not only for local purposes, but also international. So in addition to providing, for example, local pollination for growing food, these tropical rainforests that contain so many of the solutions to human problems, like medicines, about 70% of our medicines come directly from nature. And there's new scientific discoveries, which are absolutely key to finding new solutions to diseases and of course, to also climate-related health problems. So you've got a lot of the financing needs are about what's needed to protect intact ecosystems that can contain these solutions and that provide ecosystem services. It's to restore degraded ecosystems so that they can absorb carbon, so that they don't release more greenhouse gases, as Thomas was saying, and to ensure they can then provide the ecosystem services in the future. But also money is needed to take out the harmful subsidies. There's still a huge number of environmentally harmful subsidies from, of course, fossil fuel subsidies, but also a lot of agricultural subsidies that encourage intensive farming practices that damage biodiversity. And the EU is especially culpable in this regard. One of the first and best things the EU could do, the proverbial low-hanging fruit, is in fact to reduce the CAP subsidies that damage nature.
That's the common agricultural policy, I believe.
Indeed. So one of the first and best things that the European Union could do is to reduce the nature-harming subsidies, especially under the common agricultural policy. But we have to think about this as not just finance for nature as an intrinsic good, that's important, but we have to think about also the economics of biodiversity, something that is still not really very well understood. And Thomas was somebody who worked on a very famous review done by Partha Dasgupta, Cambridge economist, for the UK Finance Ministry, the Treasury, a few years ago, which pointed out some real basics about the fact that our demands on nature far exceed nature's capacity to supply us with the goods and services that we rely on. And there are very few prices or values for nature in the current economic system that would balance that supply and demand. And so this thing of bringing nature onto the balance sheet is really key, because if it just remains something for philanthropic and public donations almost, there's no way that we will be able to maintain nature at levels that serve the whole economy.
Thomas, you want to expand on that? Tell us about how the report came to be and how it's making its way into practice, if it is?
Yeah, sure. And thanks, Heather, for that very generous overview of it. Yeah, so I think to build on what Heather said, I mean, the economics of biodiversity, the review was commissioned in around 2020 by the UK government. It was independently led by Sapafa Disgupta, and really looked at, you know, kind of put this into thing, kind of what, in terms of economic and financial aspects, kind of why does nature matter? And thinking more generally about how we should think about nature more systemically as part of our economic and financial systems. I think as Heather touched on, I mean, a lot of what was in the report, in some sense, and I know Parfa was at great pains to always underscore it, was kind of revealing kind of simple truths that we collectively have seemed to forgotten, but forgotten in a way that have become really ingrained in our economic financial systems through, you know, cold hard things such as modeling data and what we report on. So in terms of kind of one of the fundamentals, again, really drawing on, you know, ecological and earth science data and, you know, research that's been around for a long time, is that ultimately our economies, our financial systems, our societies are embedded within nature. We're not external to it. Now, that might seem completely obvious to anyone listening in. You kind of only look outside and think, I'm not one removed from the wildlife near me, or, you know, the kind of the nice parks and the kind of woodlands. But, you know, when you look at most mainstream kind of economic models for the past, you know, half a century, they have implicitly included that we can be removed from that kind of finite supply of nature around us. You know, we do have bounds on the economy. We do have bounds in the financial system. There is not an infinite amount of natural resource. And so really, when you start to recognize those kind of fundamental truths that we know from ecology and earth science, and we're starting to see the pressures on nature globally. I think Heather mentioned a little bit about of our unsustainable engagement. I mean, one fact, which I think is always, you know, increasingly telling because it kind of ratchets us up every couple of years, is at this point in time, for every year, we're using around 1.75 Earths, the kind of resources that we need to be able to sustain the global economy. Now, anyone knows that you cannot use something 1.8 times more than you have every year to be sustainable. That is by definition unsustainable. But how have we got to that point? Now, the review obviously kind of outlines a lot about the institutional failure, going beyond market failure, going on to, as Heather mentioned, you know, kind of the inability really of us to value nature in a lot of the things we do and a lot of the kind of systems that we've created and institutions. But what the review also pointed out is, you know, there is, through recognizing, and there has been progress on different fronts to be able to do that. And really, it's about, you know, embedding nature back in to kind of our economic systems, whether it be through our economic models that, you know, we use day to day, whether it be in the kind of the market, whether it be in the kind of central banks, or whether it be in government, recognizing that you need to put nature back into the heart of fundamentals that actually drive decision making in the economy and financial systems, if we want to be able to have an economy and financial system that's driving positive outcomes for nature.
Thanks so much for that. As we move into the next section of our podcast, I'd like to go a little bit deeper on how we get this on paper. It's one thing to imagine governments factoring this into their budget. You know, we're going to pay for wetland preservation. We're going to focus not just on saving a salamander, but also on saving the salamander habitat. But it's another thing to attribute that to individual private sector balance sheets. Thomas, do you see any way for more firms to get their head around how to make this financially material for them?
Yes, really good question. And I think there's been a lot of development and kind of support for firms all over the world, actually, in recent years on this. The kind of chief one has been the work of the Task Force on Nature-Related Financial Disclosures. That's been a market-led, science-based, but government-supported initiative that really has developed a risk management and disclosure framework to help every single firm, no matter size, no matter where they are, ultimately be able to identify and assess their nature-related dependencies and impacts. So depending on where they are in a value chain, depending on where they are in terms of a sector or geographic location, be able to understand, using the tools and data available, what are the key aspects of nature they depend on and what are they impacting on first and foremost. And through that, then being able to supply, which the TNFD does, guidance and tools and methods to be able to assess how could that translate into risk. And the risk factors, I think Heather mentioned, was brought to life a little bit, you know, kind of mainly stem from three elements. One is physical risk. So if we have physical disruptions, whether that be kind of acute shocks from nature, if they're kind of, you know, dramatic collapses in certain ecosystems, or, you know, kind of immediate spreads of zoonotic diseases such as COVID-19, or chronic impacts, you know, whether it be the kind of declining health of soil and the impact that's having on, you know, particularly agriculture. Through recognizing that physical risks are crystallizing in regard to nature, transition risks as we transition to economy that's aligned with the goals and aims and ambition of the Quinn McMontreal Global Biodiversity Framework, which was agreed by nearly 200 countries only 2 years ago, and which has a kind of as very specific targets, which we could talk about in a bit, but also systemic risks. So thinking kind of more generally, if there's broader systemic collapses, what are the impacts? How could that translate into, you know, forms of risk that most firms know quite well, you know, market, credit, liquidity, operational risk. I'm thinking about how can they start to crystallize through those transmission channels. So there's an increasing amount of guidance and tools there. You're starting to see a really growing number of firms all over the world starting to use and apply these techniques to really understand how can you start to think about, both from a quantitative but also qualitative sense, how could this show up in your balance sheet? And then crucially, what can you be doing as a firm to respond to that potential exposure?
And this is where central banks and others who are responsible for the overall stability and health of the financial sector are getting involved too. For example, the European Central Bank has done research on how many euro area loans are to companies that are highly dependent on one or more ecosystem service. And they found that 3/4 of corporate loans are highly exposed to the loss of ecosystem, even just one ecosystem service. So when you get those kinds of physical, sudden catastrophe risks, like, for example, the floods that we've seen recently in Spain, or indeed the chronic impacts that Thomas was saying, this needs to affect credit ratings. It needs, and it's something that central banks and other regulators have to take on board, because that could happen to a whole sector at the same time. And it's through the central banks requiring systemically important banks to report on their exposure that they then ask their clients more about it. And then people start to discover risks that were always there but simply weren't accounted for. So it's almost like invisible ink showing up on balance sheets. Oh, look, we didn't realize this was all here. Here it is. And that's really important, because that's what's going to keep the whole system healthy in the longer run.
It's super interesting. And it's also kind of a wake-up call to use the word ecosystem in its original context. So often in financial services, we hear about the venture capital ecosystem, the market trading ecosystem. But here we're talking about the natural world ecology, the ecosystem of our planet. And that does have a different effect, as Thomas pointed out, because the planet is somewhat finite, than in some of these other contexts where it's more of a metaphor.
And that's where also this is the loss of nature has immediate local impacts, for example, loss of pollination, but it also has regional ones. So think about the Central African forests. If the forests of Gabon are not protected and they degrade to the point where they are no longer providing the hydrological cycles, then the Nile loses its water. And if you think about the millions of people and businesses that depend on the Nile, that's going to have cascading impacts on the whole region and ultimately internationally, because people are going to be forced to move. So it's the protection of the forests is not only for the sake of the gorillas, it's also for the sake of all of the millions of people who depend on the water supply that comes from those cycles.
It's a great example of the link between climate and nature. To bring it back to finance, since we are an economics podcast, the European Union has really stressed what they're calling double materiality in some of these sustainable finance goals. Whereas most of the world is focused on green impact that they can put a number on it and put it on their balance sheet, and maybe they have to tell their shareholders about it if it's a serious risk. The EU also asks to put a value on these other types of risks to the broader environment. Thomas, you're in the UK, you're sort of straddling these worlds. How does that look to you? And how can we think through this, particularly in the context of nature?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, so I think, like you said, this kind of issue of materiality is kind of a very fierce debate across the world. And yeah, you kind of touched on it. Essentially, it kind of is covering the aspect of looking at the materiality, the financial materiality from a business of, in this case, you know, the degradation of nature. But on the flip side, for that kind of double aspect, looking at the kind of materiality on the state of nature from the impacts a firm is having. And as you mentioned, there is different kind of reporting requirements globally with the EU through, you know, kind of the CSRD and other legislation being on that double materiality side. I mean, what I would say that a lot of the kind of frameworks and initiatives out there, such as the TNFD disclosure requirements, have allowed for a flexible approach. You know, I kind of mentioned a little bit earlier about how they support that kind of interfacing, supporting that identify and assessment of that interface of any firm with their dependencies and impacts, and thereby allows or facilitates an organization to have all the understanding, data, knowledge that they know that they need to be able to kind of disclose them on both fronts. I mean, I think what I would say in terms of understanding impacts is what's also increasingly clear in terms of as an organization is when thinking about the dependencies and impacts on nature or that interface, there's increasing recognition and increasing evidence that, you know, kind of more degraded or less intact, as Heather mentioned, ecosystems, which are driven by adverse impacts, can also have this vicious feedback loop, which can also drive further adverse impacts for a firm through the dependency aspect. So I think there's an aspect here of, even if thinking solely about the impact on a firm through their kind of balance sheets and their activities, there is this increasing recognition that monitoring, assessing the state of nature where you have that interface as an organization, whether it be a real economy firm or a financial institution, is important in and of itself to be able to even better understand those potential financial and economic feedback loops. And so one of the things that really has gathered momentum, particularly over the last year, through the Nature Positive Initiative, which is a global initiative being supported by a wide range of, you know, really credible and like leading organizations in this space, including a number of conservation organizations, has been looking at trying to agree a common set of state of nature metrics, because for a long time, I mean, for us in the nature space, you know, there's not been, unlike on the climate space, a greenhouse gas protocol. There is no kind of way to measure and monitor systemically nature. And that has impacted in terms of state of nature and kind of assessing different ecosystems and their conditions. There's a variety of measures and indicators. And so really being able to consolidate that, again, with supporting that assessment from organizations, could really help all organizations better understand what's the state of nature where I'm interfacing with it, what are the potential impacts, and what am I potentially contributing to any adverse outcomes, and thereby how can I use that information and data and through changing my activities to support more positive outcomes for nature in the spaces that I operate. So I think you are starting to see that, and again, work by the Nature Positive Initiative, I think, is recognition that there is growing demand from the market to be able to understand this better to help support positive outcomes on the ground.
Heather, how much do you think the EU can be a leader on this and sort of encourage other people to work with them versus an antagonist and someone who's seen as maybe pushing values down other people's throats or otherwise trying to control things outside its borders? I mean, this is a tension we see a lot on Save the Planet kind of stuff in Europe, and it seems like it could really be an issue here.
Extraterritoriality is always an issue, as we've just seen with, for example, the deforestation regulation, where the EU was acknowledging its responsibility for all of the damage that gets done to forests in order to produce goods for Europeans to buy. And yet that has an impact on the countries where those goods are made, and therefore, and also biomass is grown and so on. So it's a tricky issue because European consumption is very high. We have have, for example, five times the material footprint from the average African. That's big, and that's important. But of course, you also need to ensure that trade partners are able to adjust and that they have support from the EU, particularly through development policies, to make the adaptation to new regulation which protects nature. So clearly, there's an international side in terms of financing and assistance. But this thing of setting the right incentives is really key, because nature is above all a common resource problem. The incentives for the preservation and restoration of biodiversity are dwarfed by the scale of incentives for activities that damage nature. And some of those incentives are market access in the European Union. So you do need to address that. You can't just kind of say, well, we're agnostic on this point. We're just going to look at restoring nature in the EU, which is very much needed. 80% of habitats in the EU are in poor condition, for example. But it's got to be done well and through international cooperation as well, which is why this biodiversity COP is important too. But I think we do have to think of it as something where the state has a role and regulators have a role, because this is not going to happen through markets alone, because this is literally a common good which is free for the taking. And if you don't ensure that somebody pays for maintenance and restoration, we will keep losing it at such a high rate that, you know, as Thomas was pointing out earlier, we would need 1.8 Earths to cover it. So now we have to think about, I think, several different roles for the EU. One is its international role. Another one is simply encouraging the kinds of things like green bonds, payment for ecosystem services, debt for nature swaps. The EU can play a role in these kinds of mechanisms of providing financing, and to provide also regulatory solutions which can be applied elsewhere too. So regulatory solutions like, for example, putting a price on nature in different ways. That's not going to happen only through the private sector.
Into the last section of our podcast, I want to come back to this issue of money and who's going to pay for it. What do we need here? Do we need budgets? Do we need tradable nature credits? Do we need, as you said, just to cut back on farm subsidies and other things? Thomas, what would you like to see? Is there anything that you think the market would get more excited about?
Well, I think the first thing to flip on his head is who is paying for it already? And those are, you know, particularly when you're starting to see some of the ecosystems that have been degraded, and particularly kind of where in the world, you know, it's predominantly emerging market and developing economies. And within those kind of, you know, those towards the kind of more fortunate ends of society in terms of income levels that are already starting to see the impact. So, you know, we should be clear that people are already paying for it. And I think in terms of when we talk about a lot of the risks that nature brings, you know, I think from speaking to a lot of people in emerging markets, developing economies, they class these as impacts. They're already seeing this show up. So again, this is also something, you know, from being kind of in an advanced economy and through supply chains and how our global economy works, we are, you know, kind of one step removed, being in Europe to some extent, given some of the crystallization. Now, to your question on kind of how to pay for it, who to pay for it, and I think Heather's kind of run through the numbers on it. I think there's kind of two aspects as well to bring out. I think, which if I center this within what's being agreed, as I mentioned, in the Kunming and Montreal Global Biodiversity Framework through the Convention for Biological Diversity Convention, the COP, that's the kind of sister COP to the I think the more well-known climate COP, is there was an agreement in terms of financing, predominantly, as Heather mentioned, financing for conservation and restoration of nature. And again, given that this is, you know, inherently to an extent public, you know, these are public goods, there will always be an element of kind of public-private financing. And I think there are increasing number of financial instruments, which I know in Heather's paper, she's really well outlined in terms of thinking about, you know, different kind of credit mechanisms and other payment ecosystem services that can really help spur and kind of fuse public and private financing models together. Now, in addition to conservation and restoration, and the Global Biodiversity Framework makes clear that around 30%, we need 30% of the world's land and sea protected by 2030. Now, that leaves the rest of the 70% of the planet. That's the rest of the 70% of the planet that our economies, that our financial systems will most, for its entirety, operate in. And crucially, within that spectrum, we need to see kind of reductions in terms of the impacts on nature, because the economy will exist in parts that aren't protected. And that will, you know, for any business or financial institution, that's looking about, you know, doing investments, changing business models, changing activities in a way that reduces pressures on nature. And I think in, you know, when you're starting to look at many examples of where that's happening, whether that be, you know, regenerative agriculture, whether that be kind of looking at different forms of sustainably sourcing pharmaceuticals, you know, there are win-wins here. There are aspects of reducing, you know, your ability, your dependence on natural resources. You're looking at using them more effectively and efficiently, using, you know, new technologies to be able to produce the same amount to arguably a better quality. But again, you're using less, you're extracting less from the Earth's resources. So I think there's a lot of innovation. There's kind of a huge kind of increase in terms of private financing there. I think, you know, sometimes the numbers, you know, kind of are a little bit in their infancy because they're not capturing everything. But you are starting to see, whether it be driven by, you know, climate considerations or not, even more so now by nature considerations, looking at how to more sustainably use natural resources as a kind of day-to-day consideration of businesses and financial institutions. And I think that's where you're starting to see an increasing role of private finance and playing a part.
I agree with all that. And I think we have to be really clear that private finance is not going to plug the gap. And it's really important that shiny, new, exciting financial instruments do not start to crowd out public funding, which will still be necessary because of the lack of pricing. So this is still a common resource that is not inherently profit-making in terms of particularly the protection of nature. So there must be additionality. This is a really fundamental principle, that the private finance must be additional to public. It shouldn't crowd it out. And also, it needs to have sustainability over time. It's absolutely vital that any funding stream is a reliable source of revenue that provides permanence of protection. So, you know, it doesn't work to issue nature credits which work for this year and provide some funding to protect the forest this year, but then not next year. And so then it's cut down, because once it's cut down, it's cut down. So the reliability of funding to ensure the preservation of biodiversity for future generations, for really a long term, is fundamental. Once a species goes extinct, it's extinct forever. Once a habitat is lost, then it's really often extremely expensive to restore it. But that also takes us into the issue of the costs of not doing it. Because again, it's often seen as, okay, we're preserving great iconic species like lions and tigers because we like to look at them. But this is actually about really fundamental things, that once you've chopped down, for example, a mangrove, it can no longer filter the water, and so the fish go away. That means that a local community, which was a fishing community, doesn't have its fundamental livelihood. And what can those people do? Well, often they have to move. Often they have to go somewhere else, and that puts pressure on another community as people come in because they can't live where they lived before. So these are very deep problems, and as Thomas was saying, they often fall on the poorest in society. They're the ones who are paying for it now, and it's the poorest countries. And so, in fact, restoration of ecosystems is incredibly cheaper than trying to replace them with human technology. Many of the ecosystem services either cannot be replaced with human technology at all, or it's extremely expensive. Imagine trying to do what they're doing in southern China now, pollinating apple trees by hand because there are no flying pollinators left because they've been wiped out by pesticides. That's extremely expensive. Or cleaning water through human technology, through desalination and so on, so much more expensive than the natural ecosystem doing it. Or trying to filter air. We saw how hard the Chinese government tried to do that. Incredibly difficult to do that. So ecosystems are very efficient at providing the services because they've developed for millions of years through evolution. For us to try and replace that with human technology at scale would be extremely expensive.
What are the top three recommendations that might come out of your work, Heather?
So the first is look at what are the what's the structure of incentives that's set up by the current system. So if the current structure of incentives is rewarding destruction of nature, then you need to work out how to stop that. And that might be by ending harmful subsidies and putting a price on destruction. So the polluter pays principle. Look at what kinds of financing might be available for restoring nature. So the many things that Thomas was talking about earlier. And we need to just start to include the economics of biodiversity in mainstream economics.
Thomas, anything you could add to that?
I think the one thing I would add, which kind of maybe overlays it all and touches on Heather's previous point as well, in terms of trying to make sure that funding or finance, whether it be public or private, ultimately is getting to the sources and outcomes we need, is also, you know, on the private side, what's the one thing that kind of matters for all types of private investment is policy coherence and clarity. And also on the public sector side, as I think as Heather mentioned, you know, a lot of these instruments, when it comes to talking about conservation and restoration, and in terms of thinking about length of projects, they need very long-term commitments, you know, the very long-term kind of funding and investment propositions. So ensuring that there is that coherence and clarity from governments, from policymakers, is absolutely vital. And in particular, you know, what we're increasingly seeing, or increasingly, you know, what's being apparent, is recognizing how will countries, how will nations deliver on the targets, the goals agreed through the Quinlan-Montreal Global Biodiversity Framework. I mean, to date, we've only seen around 44 out of 196 parties actually set out that strategy, which again, that's setting out how will that jurisdiction, how will that government, how will that jurisdiction, the policymakers expect to deliver on targets. And so that includes conservation and restoration. I know the EU has been one that has set that out. But if we really want to be able to crowd in private financing, but then also crucially identify how will public financing, and I think as Heather mentioned it, how will we phase out these harmful perverse subsidies, which ultimately, I think as Heather said, are having an influence on market pricing to a degree, which is then going to be impacting other you know, efforts to finance positive outcomes. How will they be phased out? So I think that's increasingly, it's looking for that policy coherence and clarity. I think national transition planning, that is countries setting out how are they going to deliver on their climate and nature ambitions in a very strategic, coherent sense, is increasingly gathering traction as private organizations, corporates and financial institutions are also being increasingly asked to provide transition planning themselves. And so, you know, getting to this stage where we can have whole economy transition planning, where government-led transition plans and corporate and business and financial institution transition plans are feeding and kind of really supporting each other, I think is a way that can helpfully bring a lot of this together too.
Thanks so much for that. We've been talking today with Heather Graby, senior fellow at Bruegel and one of the co-authors with Luca Moffat of a Bruegel paper on biodiversity and economic world. We are joined by Thomas Viegas coming from Aviva in the UK. This has been The Sound of Economics from Bruegel. You can find our podcast on all your regular podcast channels. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.